Chapter 19. Of carrying of herself. And when I saw the poor countess I had known her well to speak to, lying dead, with her throat cut, on the floor of her bedroom, you'll believe me, that a variety of reflections calculated to make a man rather low in his spirits, came into my head. That's neither here nor there. I went to the house the morning after the murder, and examined the body, and made a general observation of the bedroom where it was. Turning down the pillow of the bed with my hand, I found, underneath it, a pair of gloves. A pair of gentlemen's dress gloves, very dirty, and inside the lining, the letters TR, and a cross. Well, sir, I took them gloves away, and I showed them to the magistrate, over at Union Hall, before whom the case was. He says, Weald, he says, there's no doubt this is a discovery that may lead to something very important, and what you have got to do, Weald, is to find out the owner of these gloves. I was of the same opinion, of course, and I went at it immediately. I looked at the gloves pretty narrowly, and it was my opinion that they had been cleaned. There was a smell of sulfur and rosin about them, you know, which clean gloves usually have, more or less. I took them over to a friend of mine at Kennington, who was in that line, and I put it to him. What do you say now? Have these gloves been cleaned? These gloves have been cleaned, says he. Have you any idea who cleaned them? Says one. Not at all, says he. I've a very distinct idea who didn't clean them, and that's myself. But I'll tell you what, Weald, there ain't above 8 or 9 reglar glove cleaners in London. There were not, at that time, it seems, and I think I can give you their addresses, and you may find out, by that means, who did clean them. Accordingly, he gave me the directions, and I went here, and I went there, and I looked up this man, and I looked up that man. But, though they all agreed that the gloves had been cleaned, I couldn't find the man, woman, or child that had cleaned that aforesaid pair of gloves. What with this person not being at home, and that person being expected home in the afternoon, and so forth, the inquiry took me 3 days. On the evening of the third day, coming over Waterloo Bridge from the Surrey side of the river, quite beat, and very much vexed and disappointed, I thought I'd have a shilling's worth of entertainment at the Lyceum Theatre to freshen myself up. So I went into the pit, at half price, and I sat myself down next to a very quiet, modest sort of young man. Seeing I was a stranger, which I thought it just as well to appear to be, he told me the names of the actors on the stage, and we got into conversation. When the play was over, we came out together, and I said, we've been very companionable and agreeable, and perhaps you wouldn't object to a drain. Well, you're very good, says he, I shouldn't object to a drain. Accordingly, we went to a public house, near the theater, sat ourselves down in a quiet room upstairs on the first floor, and called for a pint of half and half, a piece, and a pipe. Well, sir, we put our pipes aboard, and we drank our half and half, and sat a-talking, very sociably, when the young man says, you must excuse me stopping very long, he says, because I'm forced to go home in good time. I must be at work all night. At work all night? Says one. You ain't a baker? No, he says, laughing, I ain't a baker. I thought not, says I, you haven't the looks of a baker. No, says he, I'm a glove cleaner. I never was more astonished in my life than when I heard them words come out of his lips. You're a glove cleaner, are you? Says one. Yes, he says, I am. Then, perhaps, says I, taking the gloves out of my pocket, you can tell me who cleaned this pair of gloves? It's a rum story, I says. I was dining over at Lambeth, the other day, at a free and easy quite promiscuous with a public company when some gentleman, he left these gloves behind him. Another gentleman and me, you see, we laid a wager of a sovereign, that I wouldn't find out who they belonged to. I've spent as much as 7 shillings already, in trying to discover. But, if you could help me, I'd stand another 7 and welcome. You see, there's TR and a cross inside.
I see, he says.
Bless you, I know these gloves very well. I've seen dozens of pairs belonging to the same party.
No?
Says one.
Yes, says he.
Then you know who cleaned them?
Says one.
Rather so, says he.
My father cleaned them.
Where does your father live?
Says one.
Just round the corner, says the young man, near Exeter Street, here.
He'll tell you who they belong to, directly.
Would you come round with me now?
Says one.
Certainly, says he, but you needn't tell my father that you found me at the play, you know, because he mightn't like it.
All right.
We went round to the place, and there we found an old man in a white apron, with two or three daughters, all rubbing and cleaning away at lots of gloves, in a front parlor.
Oh, father, says the young man, here's a person been, and made a bet about the ownership of a pair of gloves, and I've told him you can settle it.
Good evening, sir, says I to the old gentleman. Here's the gloves your son speaks of.
Letters TR, you see, and a cross.
Oh yes, he says, I know these gloves very well. I've cleaned dozens of pairs of them. They belong to Mr. Trinkle, the great upholsterer in Cheapside.
Did you get them from Mr. Trinkle, direct,
says I, if you'll excuse my asking the question?
No, says he, Mr. Trinkle always sends them to Mr. Phipps, the haberdasher's, opposite his shop, and the haberdasher sends them to me.
Perhaps you wouldn't object to a drain?
Says one.
Not in the least, says he.
So I took the old gentleman out, and had a little more talk with him and his son, over a glass, and we parted excellent friends. This was late on a Saturday night. First thing on the Monday morning, I went to the haberdasher's shop, opposite Mr. Trinkle's, the great upholsterer's in Cheapside.
Mr. Phipps in the way?
My name is Phipps.
Oh, I believe you sent this pair of gloves to be cleaned?
Yes, I did, for young Mr. Trinkle over the way.
There he is in the shop.
Oh,
that's him in the shop, is it?
Him in the green coat?
The same individual.
Well, Mr. Phipps, this is an unpleasant affair, but the fact is, I am Inspector Weald of the Detective Police, and I found these gloves under the pillow of the young woman that was murdered the other day, over in the Waterloo Road.
Good heaven, says he. He's a most respectable young man, and if his father was to hear of it, it would be the ruin of him.
I'm very sorry for it, says I, but I must take him into custody.
Good heaven, says Mr. Phipps, again, can nothing be done?
Nothing, says one.
Will you allow me to call him over here, says he, that his father may not see it done?
I don't object to that, says I, but unfortunately, Mr. Phipps, I can't allow of any communication between you.
If any was attempted, I should have to interfere directly.
Perhaps you'll beckon him over here?
... Mr. Phipps went to the door and beckoned, and the young fellow came across the street directly, a smart, brisk young fellow.
Good morning, sir, says one.
Good morning, sir, says he.
Would you allow me to inquire, sir, says I, if you ever had any acquaintance with a party of the name of Grimwood?
Grimwood.
Grimwood.
Says he.
No.
You know the Waterloo Road?
Oh, of course I know the Waterloo Road.
Happen to have heard of a young woman being murdered there?
Yes, I read it in the paper, and very sorry I was to read it.
Here's a pair of gloves belonging to you, that I found under her pillow the morning afterwards.
He was in a dreadful state, sir, a dreadful state,
Mr. Weald, he says, upon my solemn oath I never was there. I never so much as saw her, to my knowledge, in my life.
I am very sorry, says I, to tell you the truth.
I don't think you are the murderer, but I must take you to Union Hall in a cab.
However, I think it's a case of that sort, that, at present, at all events, the magistrate will hear it in private.
A private examination took place, and then it came out that this young man was acquainted with a cousin of the unfortunate Eliza Grimwood, and that,
Calling to see his cousin a day or two before the murder, he left his gloves upon the table. Who should come in, shortly afterwards, but Eliza Grimwood. "Whose gloves are these?" she says, taking them up. "Those are Mr. Trinkle's gloves," says her cousin. "Oh," says she, "they are very dirty, and of no use to him, I am sure. I shall take them away for my girl, to clean the stoves with." And she put them in her pocket. The girl had used them to clean the stoves, and, I have no doubt, had left them lying on the bedroom mantelpiece, or on the drawers, or somewhere, and her mistress, looking round to see that the room was tidy, had caught them up, and put them under the pillow where I found them. That's the story, sir. Apostrophe, 2. The artful touch, one of the most beautiful things that ever was done, perhaps, apostrophe said Inspector Weald, emphasizing the adjective, as preparing us to expect dexterity or ingenuity, rather than strong interest, was a move of Sergeant Wycham's. It was a lovely idea. Wycham and me were down at Epsom one Derby day, waiting at the station for the swell mob. As I mentioned, when we were talking about these things before, we are ready at the station when there's races, or an agricultural show, or a chancellor sworn in for an university, or Jenny Lind, or anything of that sort. And as the swell mob come down, we send them back again by the next train. But some of the swell mob, on the occasion of this derby that I refer to, so far kidded us as to hire a horse and shay, start away from London by Whitechapel, and miles round, come into Epsom from the opposite direction, and go to work, right and left, on the course, while we were waiting for them at the rail. That, however, ain't the point of what I'm going to tell you. While Wycham and me were waiting at the station, there comes up one Mr. Tat, a gentleman formerly in the public line, quite an amateur detective in his way, and very much respected. "Halloa, Charlie Weald," he says. "What are you doing here? On the lookout for some of your old friends?" "Yes, the old move, Mr. Tat. Come along," he says, "you and Wycham, and have a glass of sherry. We can't stir from the place," says I, "till the next train comes in, but after that, we will with pleasure." Mr. Tat waits, and the train comes in, and then Wycham and me go off with him to the hotel. Mr. Tat, he's got up quite regardless of expense, for the occasion, and in his shirt front there's a beautiful diamond prop, cost him 15 or 20 pounds, a very handsome pin indeed. We drink our sherry at the bar, and have had our 3 or 4 glasses, when Wycham cries suddenly, "Look out, Mr. Weald! Stand fast!" And a dash is made into the place by the swell mob, 4 of them that have come down as I tell you, and in a moment Mr. Tat's prop is gone. Wycham, he cuts him off at the door. I lay about me as hard as I can. Mr. Tat shows fight like a good un, and there we are, all down together, heads and heels, knocking about on the floor of the bar. Perhaps you never see such a scene of confusion. However, we stick to our men, Mr. Tat being as good as any officer, and we take them all, and carry them off to the station. Apostrophe, the station's full of people, who have been took on the course, and it's a precious piece of work to get them secured. However, we do it at last, and we search them, but nothing's found upon them, and they're locked up, and a pretty state of heat we are in by that time, I assure you. I was very blank over it, myself, to think that the prop had been passed away, and I said to Wycham, when we had set him to rights, and were cooling ourselves along with Mr. Tat, "We don't take much by this move, anyway, for nothing's found upon him, and it's only the braggadocia, too, after all." "What do you mean, Mr. Weald?" says Wycham. "Here's the diamond pin." And in the palm of his hand there it was, safe and sound. "Why, in the name of wonder," says me and Mr. Tat, in astonishment, "how did you come by that?" "I'll tell you how I come by it," says he. "I saw which of them took it, and when we were all down on the floor together, knocking about, I just gave him a little touch on the back of his hand, as I knew his pal would, and he thought it was his pal, and gave it me. It was beautiful, beautiful. Even that was hardly the best of the case, for that chap was tried at the quarter sessions at Guildford. You know what quarter sessions are, sir? Well, if you'll believe me, while them slow justices were looking over the Acts of Parliament, to see what they could do to him, I'm blowed if he didn't cut out of the dock before their faces. He cut out of the dock, sir, then and there, swam across a river, and got up into a tree to dry himself. In the tree he was took an old woman having seen him climb up, and Witcham's artful touch transported him. ..3. The sofa, what young men will do, sometimes, to ruin themselves and break their friends' hearts, ..said Sergeant Thornton, it's surprising. I had a case at St. Blank's Hospital which was of this sort. A bad case, indeed, with a bad end. The secretary, and the house surgeon, and the treasurer, of St. Blank's Hospital, came to Scotland Yard, to give information of numerous robberies having been committed on the students. The students could leave nothing in the pockets of their greatcoats, while the greatcoats were hanging at the hospital, but it was almost certain to be stolen. Property of various descriptions was constantly being lost, and the gentlemen were naturally uneasy about it, and anxious, for the credit of the institution, that the thief or thieves should be discovered. The case was entrusted to me, and I went to the hospital. Now, gentlemen, said I, after we had talked it over, I understand this property is usually lost from one room. Yes, they said. It was. I should wish, if you please, said I, to see the room. It was a good-sized bare room downstairs, with a few tables and forms in it, and a row of pegs, all round, for hats and coats. Next, gentlemen, said I, do you suspect anybody? Yes, they said. They did suspect somebody. They were sorry to say, they suspected one of the porters. I should like, said I, to have that man pointed out to me, and to have a little time to look after him. He was pointed out, and I looked after him, and then I went back to the hospital, and said, now, gentlemen, it's not the porter. He's, unfortunately for himself, a little too fond of drink, but he's nothing worse. My suspicion is, that these robberies are committed by one of the students, and if you'll put me a sofa into that room where the pegs are as there's no closet I think I shall be able to detect the thief. I wish the sofa, if you please, to be covered with chintz, or something of that sort, so that I may lie on my chest, underneath it, without being seen. The sofa was provided, and next day at 11 o'clock, before any of the students came, I went there, with those gentlemen, to get underneath it. It turned out to be one of those old-fashioned sofas with a great crossbeam at the bottom, that would have broken my back in no time, if I could ever have got below it. We had quite a job, to break all this away in the time. However, I fell to work, and they fell to work, and we broke it out, and made a clear place for me. I got under the sofa, lay down on my chest, took out my knife, and made a convenient hole in the chintz to look through. It was then settled between me and the gentlemen, that when the students were all up in the wards, one of the gentlemen should come in, and hang up a great coat on one of the pegs. And that that great coat should have, in one of the pockets, a pocketbook containing marked money. After I had been there some time, the students began to drop into the room, by ones, and twos, and threes, and to talk about all sorts of things, little thinking there was anybody under the sofa, and then to go upstairs. At last there came in one who remained. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.